WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Love Story, Rosemary's Baby, Chinatown, and The Godfather, Parts 1 and 2, were produced by my guest, Robert Evans. As the head of production at Paramount, he used to be one of Hollywood's greatest power brokers. But he lost his power and money when he made The Cotton Club. Not only were there serious behind-the-scenes problems with the film, but one of the potential backers Evans brought on was murdered. Evans was loosely implicated, but never charged. In 1992, he returned to Paramount and made his comeback with the erotic thriller Sliver, starring Sharon Stone. The movie was a box office disappointment in the States. Evans is making more movies at Paramount, and now he's telling the story of his rise and fall, an attempt to rise again, in his new memoir, The Kid Stays in the Picture. We invited him to talk with us about a couple of the great films he produced. Let's start with The Godfather.
I met Mario Puzo as a favor to a literary agent friend of mine named George Weezer, and he needed money to pay off the bookies, actually. And he had this treatment called Mafia. It was 60 pages, and he said the word mafia had never been used before. It was found in the Kefauver Committee, and I was always interested in that kind of a movie. So I gave him $12,000 just to write a treatment called Mafia, and that treatment called Mafia turned into being the novel The Godfather. And we owned the novel for very, very little money because I put up the money for a treatment. And even after we owned it, and we owned it for next to nothing, they still didn't want to make the picture at Paramount because too many people said a mafia picture had never been successful, anything about the organization, as it was called before, the mafia. And there had never been one successful film made about the mafia before that. And they wanted me to sell it, and I refused to do it. And we found the reason why there had been no successful mafia films, because they had been made by Jews and not Italians.
Did you think that was the secret?
I must have been, because we had made one 2 years before with Kirk Douglas. It was directed by Marty Ritt, written by Bill Sternberg. Starred Luther Adler and Susan Strasberg and Kirk Douglas, all written and directed and produced by Jewish people. And there's a difference, a thin line between a Jew and a Sicilian. And I felt that made the difference. And that's why we gave Francis Coppola his assignment to do it. And by record, he had only made three unsuccessful films before that. Finian's Rainbow, You're a Big Boy Now, and Rain People. And hired Francis to do it, everyone thought I'd lose my job over it.
I should point out, you're Jewish, so it's kind of interesting that you really took a stand that it had to be in Italian.
Well, yes, because I was right in taking that stand. If I would have done it, I most probably wouldn't have made it the same way.
Now, several directors...
I wanted to smell the spaghetti, Terry.
Several directors turned down The Godfather. Costa Gavras, Ilya Kazan, Arthur Penn.
Not
Italians, yeah.
No Italians. There hadn't been an Italian director, second-generation Italian director in Hollywood at the time, as a matter of fact. It was pre-Martin Scorsese and other Italian directors, and Francis was the only second-generation Italian working in films at the time.
So that's how he got
the nod.
That's how he got the gig, because he was the only Italian
around? He got the gig
that
way, and he would only make it in one way. If he could tell his story as a family chronicle on capitalism in America. That's the way he described it anyway, but we had no choice at the time. And as I said, I wanted to smell that spaghetti, and one thing we did, we smelled the spaghetti.
You say that when The Godfather was being made, really most people did not want Brando to be cast.
Not most people. Nobody wanted him. Francis wanted him, and I understood why he wanted him. And the only way we got him into the picture was Francis was brilliant enough to do a silent screen test of him. And once you saw that silent screen test, you knew there's only one person to play the part. It was Marlon. At that point, Marlon's career was very deep into the red. He hadn't made a successful film in years, and he wanted the gig as well. He didn't do it for the artistic purposes. Though he had claimed he had loved the book, I didn't even believe he read it. He wanted the part, and he got the part. And he made history with it, and also made his own second history with making it.
What were your fears about using him?
None. After looking at it, I thought it was a brilliant idea. It was the people who put up the money didn't like it that much. There was a very big producer, an Italian producer, came in to see the New York office. He said, "If you use a Marlon Brando at playing The Godfather, no one in Italy will ever even go to the movie." It ended up being the biggest film ever in Italy. So that shows how few people know about anything. including myself.
You didn't want to cast Al Pacino.
No, I didn't want Al Pacino, and Francis didn't want Jimmy Caan. So we settled on Al Pacino if he would, and Jimmy Caan as a combination, because it was getting too close to shooting time. And Francis rightfully said to me, you know, you want someone who looks like you, and I want someone who looks like me. I mean, we're never going to get together in this part. So, but and he didn't want Jimmy Caan at all, because Jimmy, he had just done Rain People with him, and it got rained on pretty good.
Oh, you know, James Caan's Jewish, and you wanted to make a whole big thing about Italians in it.
But you know, but the reason I wanted James Caan was because Al is like 5'4 or 5'5, and the guy they wanted to play opposite him as part of something was 6'5, and I didn't want to see Mutton Jeff.
Uh-huh.
And there's a size range. Jimmy looked very big next to Al, but he isn't that big in person. I mean, he's an average-sized guy, 5'10 or so. But the fellow they had wanted to put next to Al, it would have looked cosmetically ludicrous. So that's the reason I went with Jimmy.
You say that when you saw Coppola's first cut, you told him he had to make it longer, that he had to put more in. And that's exactly the opposite of what I'd expect a producer to say. It's usually, the film's too long, you'd better cut it.
And not only that, it was around 2 hours and 6 minutes his cut, and we ended up with a picture close to 3 hours. He had shot everything. He had shot that spaghetti, but he took it out in the edit. He was afraid, and I understand that. The distribution company, the theaters want pictures that are 2 hours, so they get turned over. They don't like a three-hour movie. But this film was not about a slice of life. It was about an era. And it took, and it's not a little picture. The canvas was there to make it hold. You see, sometimes the longer a film is, the shorter it plays, and the shorter it is, the longer it plays. Because if you lose the text, if it's one single dimensional, it can play awfully long at 90 minutes, and it can play short at 3 hours. And we took a real chance of letting it play long. If it would have played short, it would have been The Untouchables.
You say the ending was really a mess. That there was no ending.
That's correct. There was no ending, and we had a lot of mayhem.
What was the ending like?
It wasn't written. Mm-hmm. There wasn't an ending. We were going to edit the ending, and neither Francis nor myself came up with that edit. As I talk about in the book, a man named Peter Zinner, who is one of the two editors, choreographed the mixture of the baptism of young Michael and the mass killings that went on, and it was very operatic. And Francis is a very operatic director, and he loved what he saw when it was edited together that way, though it wasn't written that way. And so many films have emulated that ending. It's among the classic endings in film history. And nothing to do with either Francis or my own talents. It was Peter Zinner's extraordinary eye and rhythm that made that baptism ending work.
Producer Robert Evans is my guest, the former head of production at Paramount. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with producer Robert Evans. He's written a new memoir called The Kid Stays in the Picture. You produced Chinatown, a great movie. You cast Jack Nicholson as the leading man in this. Why did you want him?
First of all, he had never played a straight leading man before. Secondly, I've always looked at Jack. And I discovered him, actually, not discovered him for film, but for big time film, when he was in a Barbra Streisand picture, On a Clear Day. Jack has a smile. Before he even opens his mouth, the rafters shake when he smiles. It's a billion-dollar smile. And when he starts to speak, he's mesmerizing. I think he stands alone. He stood alone then. He stands alone now as the single actor who both the young and the old relate to. And I wanted to just do a film with him, and Jack had not played this kind of a straight part before, so he wanted the courage to try to play a straight part and not use props of parts that he'd done before. So that's how he added in playing the part. His natural instinct, however, was to do something that was different, and that's how he and Roman came up with the idea of that blade going into his nose and cutting his nose wide open, and watching the cast going down to then a bandage, and the bandage less and then the scar less all through the movie was a brilliant conceptual move, and it was subliminal. You didn't realize it, but it was a great character hook for Jack to play that role. And I must tell you, when people first saw Chinatown, they looked at each other. They thought it was done in Chinese. They didn't understand it. They got to understand it pretty quick, though. It holds up today as well as it was when it was made then, and very few pictures hold up after 20, 30 years as well as, not only as well as Chinatown, hold up at all. The styles change.
I'm always very amused by how movies might have been cast and how they might have turned out differently. And so I was very amused to hear that when you were making Chinatown, you say Jane Fonda was everybody's first choice to play opposite Jack Nicholson. You know, I don't think that would have worked at all.
It wouldn't have worked nearly as well. It's all strange. Everything is what's called, quote, fashionable at the time. Jane's career at that particular moment was hotter than Faye's. Faye's is more correct for the role, but everyone's star plays all the time. I was thrilled to get Faye because she had the neuroses for this part that made it really work. You know, the part is only 7 or 8 scenes, but yet the texture of the way it's written and the mystery of the way it's written makes it as memorable as a part as she's had in her career, even though she didn't win the Academy Award for it, she was nominated for it. Chinatown was nominated for 11 Academy Awards, and no one understood the picture when it was finished. How about that?
Well, you say that Robert Towne, who wrote Chinatown, is still really angry with you about how the ending of Chinatown was changed. So how was it changed compared to what Robert Towne had originally written?
Well, Robert wanted and was definite upon it. He wanted the character that John Huston was playing to be killed at the end, and Roman wanted the Faye Dunaway character to be killed. And he felt it was more unique that way, that evil did win out at the end, and thus it didn't make it a, quote, Hollywood movie. And Robert thought Roman's thought was demented, and I was a swing vote in it, and I went along with Roman. And to this day, Bob Towne thinks it's a mistake. There's one thing, he won the Academy Award for it, but I suppose that doesn't matter. He still thinks it would have been better the other way. I mean, to this day, if you had him on your show, he'd tell you that.
I think he did.
I'm sure he must have. He only became the biggest writer in town, not to use a pun, but he did. Towne became the biggest writer in town from Chinatown.
So that famous line, "It's Chinatown, Jake," that said at the end probably wouldn't have been said at the end if the original.
Yes, it would have.
It would have been.
It would have been said anyway, but it wouldn't have made sense. See, Chinatown was not supposed to be, per se, Chinatown. It wasn't about Chinatown. It was a state of mind.
Right. Well, you know, I think today it's very difficult to make a movie where evil does win, unless it's evil winning in a kind of monster movie, so there can be a sequel where the monster returns.
You're right. Today is not... Making movies today is very much different than it was making them 20 years ago. Everything is by committee today, and the numbers are so big, maybe there's reason for it. You know, there's no such word as an independent producer. Everyone's a dependent producer, including yours truly. The only time you're independent is when you use your own money. When you use other people's money, they're the ones who are independent, and you're dependent upon their money. And it's an industry where everybody is overpaid, including myself. And when you're overpaid, it's not so easy to duplicate your position in life, so you become, unfortunately, dependent and not independent. And films today are subject to scrutiny because the budgets are so high and costs of marketing are so high that they're not left up to the integrity of the artist, and maybe rightfully so. A distribution is a tremendous voice in what happens to the film, and the front executive office is of the same. And you're just part of a consortium as to what is being made, how it's being made, and how it's to be released. It is, at the very best, to say that it's frustrating, but I understand it.
You were one of the, boy genius producers. You were very young when you got started. You were very young when you took over Paramount. Did you have to fake it at the beginning before you had any real experience?
Well, I've always been a gambler. And the business has always been made up of gamblers, the Louis B. Mayers, the Harry Cohns, the Jack Warners. If you study their lives, the David Selznicks, Sam Gold, they're all heavy, heavy gamblers, either at the crap tables or at gin or at poker. And I was always a big gambler in my life. So I took gambles as, by instinct, not by reason. It was just automatic for me to do that. And I suppose I hit a few home runs doing it, and I struck out quite a bit at times, too. But the homers make up for the strikeouts, as long as you get some homers in there, not just singles and doubles. You know, I was around a long time. As back in 1950, I've been in this business. That's a long time, Terry. God, it's 1994 now. I don't think there's a guy who's been around this business as long as me and can still talk about it.
What's the difference between how movies are produced now and how they were produced when you started off?
When I started off, the producer ran the ship. He's the one who hired the director. He's the one who bought the property. He's the one who hired the writer. When the director hires a producer, you're in big trouble. Today, the producer is like Willy Loman. He's pushed in the back. He's not even as good as what he's made. He's only as good as what he has tomorrow. The word producer is not given nearly enough credit for it, because the producer, if he's really a producer, is on the project longer than anybody else. He's the one who usually buys the property and hires everybody, and he's the one that gets very little credit for it. When I started out, the producer got a lot of credit for it.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
Robert Evans' new memoir is called The Kid Stays in the Picture. This is Fresh Air.